Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Hey, everybody. I got a great one today, you know, for a change. But this time I mean it. The brilliant Dahlia Lithwick, award-winning writer on the Supreme Court and on jurisprudence. Her fourth time on the podcast for a reason. Not only has she won awards for her coverage of the High Court for Slate, she's just a fabulous guest. And in this one, we go over the court's 2019-2020 term and its rulings in a number of very significant cases. And I was on the Senate Judiciary Committee for 8.5 years. And even though I am not a lawyer, I did play one in a sketch. And I don't know if you're aware of the amount of prep you do at SNL to research a role you play in a sketch. Let's just say I was known for asking better questions in hearings than anyone else on the committee. For example, my colleague Amy Klobuchar, she's a good questioner, and remember she asked a very good question of Kavanaugh at the second part of his confirmation hearings. Have you ever blacked out after drinking? And he said, no, have you? And she was kind of taken aback, and I think she handled it very gracefully, but she said, well, okay, so your response then is that you haven't? No, have you? And it just struck me that there are a lot of Democrats afterwards lined up to ask questions, and it seemed to me that the logical line of questioning was like, Judge Kavanaugh, I noticed when Senator Klobuchar asked you if you'd ever blacked out after you were drinking, and you said, no, have you? And it just occurred to me that you might have been just a bit overly defensive. And you know what that said to me? That said to me, oh, I see, he's an alcoholic. And then I thought, or maybe he is. And then when she asked you a second time, you said, no, of you. And then I said, okay, he is an alcoholic. Alcoholics are very, very defensive about their drinking. I also noticed that in your opening statement, you said that the four witnesses the FBI had questioned had refuted Dr. Ford's allegations. Well, they really hadn't. They had just been asked whether they remembered a party 35 years ago that nothing had happened to them, evidently, except for your friend, the friend that Dr. Ford had identified as being in the room with you, who, Mark Judge, wrote a book about being a teenage blackout drunk. And in that book, there was a teenage blackout drunk in the book named Bart O'Kavanaugh. So I guess my question is to you, Judge Kavanaugh, is, do you remember Bart O'Kavanaugh? Do you remember the blackout drunk Bart O'Kavanaugh in your class? Are you familiar? Remember him? So anyway, that's the kind of training that we'd get at SNL when you'd play a character in a sketch. Do I sound bitter? I am not. Not in the slightest. Anyway, Dahlia and I discussed the court's term this year and also the travesty of Trump's commutation of Roger Stone's sentence and the fear we share for our nation's justice system and democracy. Also, Dahlia mentions her podcast, Amicus, and an exciting one she recorded right before COVID with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and all the survivors from her Harvard Law School class, the nine women who started with her, and that drops July 21st on her podcast, Amicus, and I can't wait to hear that. And, of course, all of us are thinking about the notorious RBG. She announced that she is being treated for liver cancer. She is a tough bird. She writes brilliantly, powerfully, and she still works through the night. I went to an event about a year and a half ago at the Kennedy Center and spoke with her afterwards, and this was after the event. She was going to go home and work. She famously works through the night very often. Anyway, all of our thoughts and best wishes are with Justice Ginsburg. We need her very selfishly to make it through to January 20th, and if God forbid Trump wins, to hang on for another 4 years, which I bet she could. She is a tough old bird and a brilliant one at that. So hang on, Ginsburg. Ginsburg, hang on. Boom, 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 boom. Hang on, Ginsburg. Ginsburg, hang on. But we need Trump to lose. I have not yet read Mary Trump's book on her uncle. But you know what? I have always suspected that he has some personality problems. I don't know about you, but there seems to be something off about him. For one thing, he can't seem to ever admit that he made a mistake, which is why he continues to ignore science and handle this pandemic just as badly as it could possibly have been handled. And, you know, this is the American carnage. This is the American carnage. That's what Donald Trump has wrought. And goddamn, it's so important to get rid of this guy. Anyway, enjoy my interview with Dahlia Lithwick. My guest today is Dahlia Lithwick. This is Dahlia's fourth time on the Al Franken podcast, passing Andy Slavitt, former head of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, for the most times on the Al Franken podcast. Congratulations, Dahlia.
So I win the Al Franken podcast?
No.
Damn it.
No.
Damn it.
The Al Franken podcast is a living, breathing thing. We have a running tally, and at the moment, you're in the lead, but you didn't win anything. Now, this is the fourth time you're on. It's the first time I've read your Wikipedia.
Oh, dear.
And I see that you keep a kosher home.
I do.
Let me ask you the first question as a Jew that I always ask someone who keeps a kosher home. Are you kosher outside the home?
We are. Not like I will eat pasta at a restaurant. In fact, you and I have eaten pasta at a restaurant. So I will eat off.
How is that not kosher?
Well, if you are really hardcore, say like my parents, you would not eat off dishes at a restaurant, if it was salad. Yeah. I am not that guy, but I have kept kosher all my life, yes.
Okay, well, your parents are ridiculous.
I will let them know you said so.
Okay, besides being a frequent guest on the Al Franken podcast, Dahlia has quite an accomplished career in her own right. She was previously a frequent guest on the Al Franken show on Air America. And I think you'll recall that on two of those occasions, we discussed the confirmation hearings of John Roberts and of Samuel Alito.
I remember it well.
And in addition to those accomplishments, guesting on the Al Franken show and the Al Franken podcast, you went to law school, am I right?
You are correct.
And then some other stuff. Dahlia, of course, is one of the great writers and thought leaders on the courts and jurisprudence, writing for Slate. In fact, winning the prestigious Hillman Prize, given annually to journalists, writers, and public figures who pursue social justice and public policy for the common good, which eliminates so many journalists, writers, and public figures. And you won it, of course, for your analysis of the Supreme Court for Slate. Am I right?
Yep. Thank you.
And Dahlia is also a frequent contributor to MSNBC and has her own podcast, Amicus or Amicus. Or what does Justice Breyer call it?
We have had this fight four times. He says the word amicus. That is his pronunciation of the Latin. He's probably correct. I call it amicus, and you should too.
Yeah, he should retire. But not until January 21st, okay?
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. Okay, today we're going to talk about two things. This year's Supreme Court term and Donald Trump's commutation of his longtime friend Roger Stone's 40-month sentence for witness tampering, obstruction, and making false statements. But you want to go to the Supreme Court first?
Let's do the Supreme Court first.
Let's go first to, let's just talk about these decisions. Now, Roberts played a big role this term, and when we talked back in 2006, during his confirmation hearings, Roberts said that the job of a Supreme Court justice is to call balls and strikes, right? That's mm-hmm. a famous mm-hmm. thing. I look at him, and this over the years, and boy, does he not do that. In my mind, he's like the fifth vote on all these 5-4 decisions. And you can give kudos for him for caring about the integrity of the court, or you can give kudos to him for playing a long game. But to me, this is like, tell me what you think of this analogy. Okay, calling balls and strikes. Do you watch baseball? Are you a baseball fan?
Huge baseball fan.
Okay, so here's the situation. It's the fifth game of the World Series. Now, the home team is down 3-1. Okay? They're down by a run. They have bases loaded. It's the bottom of the fifth, and it's beginning to rain. There's a 3-2 count on the batter. Bases loaded. 2 out. The pitcher has a really good slider. The batter knows that. And the pitch comes, and it looks like it's going to be over the plate. So he starts to swing, and then he catches a spin on the ball, and the ball starts to curve down and away from him. And he knows that he's not going to hit this ball with his swing, so he tries to hold up. Okay. The pitch just maybe hits the front edge of the plate just maybe at the knees. So now Roberts, this guy tries to hold up his swing, but Roberts could call him out. He could call that a swing in the third strike, or he could call it a third strike because it just hit the little edge of the plate. But if he calls it a strike, the World Series is over because it's going to rain. The forecast says it's going to keep raining. 5 innings is an official game in baseball. He calls this guy out. The visitors win. They win their fourth game. The World Series is over. Now, does Roberts call that a ball or a strike?
I think he calls it a ball, Al.
Yeah.
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 Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's sad, isn't it? I don't know if that's sad or not, but that's what I see. He's like, let's talk about these decisions.
I think I can respond to your umpire thing just for one brief second
before no.
we do.
Okay, go ahead.
You
go
are
ahead, go
winning ahead. This podcast. I think that what I would say just in response to the balls and strikes thing is that John Roberts, when he is elevated to Chief Justice, right, he is initially tagged to replace Sandra Day O'Connor. He's just going to be an Associate Justice. As you mm-hmm. recall, Chief Justice William Rehnquist dies suddenly, and he is bounced right into the Chief Justice's seat. And I think that the only way to think about John Roberts, including the crazy locution of umpires and balls and strikes, is that he has two things that he is selling. One is, you know, the conservative legal project, that's been his life's work. That is, you know, he comes up through the Justice Department. He clerks for Rehnquist. He, no dispute that he wants all the outcomes that the owners of the ball club want. But he also has to protect all the umpires, the institution of umpiring and the legitimacy of it. And that is a job that attaches to him as Chief Justice in ways that are really different from if he were an associate. And so I just think that when he did the balls and strikes sales pitch, what he was defending was not just the conservative legal project and this myth that it is technical and logical and that there is this magic strike zone and everyone knows what it is. And that's what he was also protecting, the myth of the fair umpire on both sides, left and right. And that's what the balls and strikes thing was. It was an amazing sales pitch for the legitimacy of umpiring. And that's totally separate from the conservative outcomes he wants. And I just think that's important in teeing up June Medical, because I think that you need to understand that this is a case about the legitimacy of umpires. It's not about the strike zone. Does that make sense?
It does. Basically, this is almost an identical case to a 2016 case in Texas.
It's a carbon copy of Whole Women's Health. Whole Women's Health decided only 4 years, almost to the day earlier. And Whole Women's Health involved two regulations of abortion clinics in Texas. One, that any clinic that performed abortions had to be retrofitted as a quote unquote ambulatory surgical center. That means they had to put in HVAC machines and widen hallways so you could put two stretchers that passed each other, even though nobody needs a stretcher. All of the things that were designed so that clinics would close, that would put clinics out of business or pass on the costs of all that retrofitting to clients so that clinics would close or abortion would become prohibitively expensive. The other regulation in Whole Women's Health involved this admitting privileges rule that said that any physician who performed an abortion needed to have admitting privileges at hospitals within a 30-mile radius. And that, too, was just an effort to put abortion providers out of business, because a lot of hospitals, for complicated reasons we can get into or not, will not give abortion providers admitting privileges. So Texas put those regulations into effect. It was very clear when it passed. A lot of legislators in Texas were spiking the football and saying, yay, this is the number of clinics we're going to close. There was no real argument that this was going to advance maternal health. The Supreme Court in Whole Women's Health struck both provisions down. Justice Breyer, writing for the majority. At that time, it was a 5-3 decision because Antonin Scalia had died. So Justice Kennedy and the four liberals said there's no medical benefit to these regulations. They're unconstitutional. Louisiana, as you said, passed the exact same rule, exactly the same, not the clinics rule, but the that providers had to get these admitting privileges. The district court said, no, this is the same case. This is nuts. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said, no, this is different because Louisiana starts with an L and Texas starts with a T or something like that, and upheld the regulations. So the case comes back to the Supreme Court 4 years later, and John Roberts, the institutionalist, the protector of umpiring, says in his majority, in his opinion, he joins the four liberals, and he writes for himself separately a concurrence that becomes the law of this case. And he says, Whole Women's Health, I dissented in that case. It was wrongly decided. I still think it's wrongly decided, but this is the same damn case. Go away. And that becomes the fifth vote to strike down the Louisiana regulations.
And so it's basically, it's sort of a stare decisis.
100%. Yep. And he writes that.
And Kavanaugh, this according to the Chief Justice, was settled law. He ruled the way he did on stare decisis. Kavanaugh went the other way, right?
Right. Although, worth pointing out, all of the conservatives, every single one of them, wrote a dissent, each more overheated than the next. Kavanaugh's dissent was sort of interesting because he didn't say Roe v. Wade should be overturned. He just said, you know, these doctors should go ahead and try again to get admitting privileges in Louisiana. And, you know, if they all are denied their admitting privileges, then we can go ahead and hear this case and determine that it's maybe or maybe not unconstitutional. In other words, he was willing to let the thing play out so that there was one clinic left to serve the entire state of Louisiana. And then he would make a decision. I think Susan Collins later said, you know, he didn't say he wants to overturn Roe. He just wanted to let the thing play out, get to the point where there's one clinic or zero clinics in Louisiana, and then make a decision about whether it was unconstitutional.
So one clinic would have to handle, what, 10,000 women who seek abortion services every year in Louisiana? Is that right?
And a state that has unbelievably high outcomes for just really poor maternal health, you know, poverty, race. This is not a state in which first world care for maternal health is a big scorching victory. So this is a state that desperately needs better maternal health, especially in a pandemic. I think you're quite right. Kavanaugh was willing to say it's just way too early for the court to get involved. Let's see how this plays out, despite years of efforts, by the way, on the part of these abortion providers to get these admitting privileges. The district court is painstaking, goes through every one of them and says why this doctor and this doctor and this doctor cannot get admitting privileges. And Kavanaugh, again, doesn't say Roe v. Wade should be overturned, just says let this play out. And so Susan Collins, when confronted with the fact that her boy, her golden-haired boy, dissented in this case, said, well, he didn't say Roe v. Wade should be overturned.
It reminded me of that case where he was a circuit court judge, and he was trying to slow down this young woman who was an immigrant, right? Who needed an abortion, and he just kept delaying it, delaying it, and delaying it. I think this was something he did as an advertisement for Supreme Court.
You're exactly right. That was his audition tape. That was a new Trump administration policy that was tracking young women in shelters who were seeking to terminate pregnancies. And, you know, obviously the rates of rape in those cases are staggering. And a new administration policy that was making it impossible for these young women, these Jane Does, to terminate pregnancies. And you're exactly right, because the effect of his slow walking that litigation was that it was going to very quickly get to the place where abortion in Texas was illegal and they were out of luck. And it's exactly the same model where you pretend to be mulling it over and you just want one more kick at the can, and maybe these women just need better information and a better guardian ad litem and better choices, but the actual practical effect is running out the clock so that they cannot get the relief that they desperately want.
Which, if you ask me, seems worse.
Yeah, it's totally cruel.
That makes him a worse human being, and especially since that was the audition.
That was the audition, and he wrote language in those opinions that had nothing to do with the legal question at hand, but was just dropping breadcrumbs about how fantastically anti-choice he would be at the court. And, you know, Susan Collins, faced with that, insisted that he was not going to upset precedent.
Okay, we're going to take a break now, and we'll be back with Dahlia Lithwick.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara especially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Okay, so let's go to another another decision, Bostock v. Clayton County, which is about LGBT rights in the workplace, right? Why don't you tell us what that was and what your take on it, on that decision was?
Bostock was two consolidated cases that were brought by gay workers who claimed that they were fired from their jobs for being gay. Expressly so, and then consolidated with another case that was brought by a transgender worker fired from a funeral home for coming out and saying to her coworkers that she was transgender. Tragically, she died before these decisions came down. The question was a pretty technical question about whether Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, that is supposed to protect workers against discrimination on the basis of sex, swept in LGBTQ employees. I think it had been understood to do so, but the Supreme Court had never definitively proclaimed one way or another. And the Trump administration and the employers here were claiming that sexual orientation or status as a transgender worker is not something that is protected from firing on the basis of sex. And here is your boy, Neil Gorsuch, writing this barnstorming opinion, joined by John Roberts and the court's liberals, saying, of course, this is discrimination on the basis of sex. Of course, if you are fired because you are gay or transgender, that is just as much discrimination on the basis of sex as being fired because you're a woman or because, citing to a case, Pricewaterhouse, you're a woman who doesn't present as feminine enough. And Gorsuch does this deep, deep dive into how you interpret the language of Title VII and essentially says, go away with your trying to pull out your Ouija board and decide what the framers in the 1960s were trying to intend and trying to protect. The plain meaning of the words, the text itself says, of course, this sweeps in gender identity and LGBTQ status and transgender status. So it's a huge resounding win for LGBTQ workers across the country, including in states that don't have state civil rights protection.
That's a lot of states.
Yes, it's a lot of states had no protections. And it's just a sweeping win that says, if your employer fires you for being gay or for being transgender, you now at minimum have the right to bring a suit under Title VII. They can still lie and invent some other pretext for your firing, but at least you have that kind of basement protection. And so I think this is one of those places where, remember I said Gorsuch proved to be kind of an interesting character this term. That is probably emblematic of a way in which he surprised a lot of people, because I don't think folks looking at that oral argument, most people did not think he was going to be a thumb on the scale to protect gay workers.
I wrote you, I texted you pretty much immediately after this came down, and I texted you that I thought Alito's dissent was very gay.
Yes. Would you like to discuss that?
Probably not. I just thought it was very gay. Hey, do you get to, because you write about the Supreme Court, do these guys talk to you every once in a while?
I think I have talked to all of the justices at one time or the other. I've certainly met, I think, all of them at one time or the other, and we just did, it's going to come up on Amicus in the next week, but we just did a really cool interview with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and all of her surviving classmates from her Harvard Law School class, the nine women who started with her. So that right before COVID, I got to sit down with her and talk to her about that. So stay tuned.
Wow.
Yep.
I want to hear that. That's great. When is that?
I think it drops July 21st, but surprising no one at all, and will surprise you least of all. All of her classmates describe her, even as a 1L at Harvard, getting up in the middle of a dinner party that she and Marty were hosting to just go to her room and study. So.
And she works through the night.
Through the night, does not sleep. But it was really important to us because, you know, in all the movies, they show these random other eight women. And we wanted to sort of track down who they were and build a little archive, finding out what they did with their lives. So, yes, that's a long answer to. I have had the privilege of, I think, interviewing or talking to almost all the sitting justices.
So when next time you get to talk to Alito?
Okay.
Can you tell him? I was talking Al Franken. Said he thought your dissent in Bostock was very gay.
It will be top of my list. I will say he did the thing that would have been, Al, the thing that Justice Scalia did if he had been writing, I think, in this case, which is just append dictionary definitions from the 1960s, page after page after page of dictionary definitions to make the point that no one who signed on to Title VII intended for it to protect gay workers, and then really, like you say, with both feet jumps in and talks about diagnostic criteria and the deep antipathy to gay people at the time and how prevalent it was. So it is a tour de force of something.
I love that. He went, people just hated gay people then.
Exactly.
That couldn't have been their intention. Do you know how homophobic the entire Congress was at that time?
Yep. There's a lot of that. A lot of that. Nice stuff.
Here's one. This is Little Sisters of the Poor versus Pennsylvania. And this is on contraception. And it exempts employers who cite religious or moral objections to the part of Obamacare that requires them to provide coverage from contraception. Here's my theory, and I want you to talk to this because you watch the court all the time. I have this theory that they picked the organization Little Sisters of the Poor with the idea, like, how can they rule against Little Sisters of the Poor? Is there anything to that?
It's almost worse than that. And folks, folks should follow. I know, right? Worse than picking nuns is this. Folks should follow Marty Lederman on Twitter. He's amazing. He's a law professor who thinks about this really hard. And he's been making this point and nobody's been listening, but I think it's important. Little Sisters of the Poor are not originally in this case at all. These are a set of cases that are consolidated. New Jersey, Pennsylvania. They're not parties to this case. They actually ask to join this case, the Little Sisters of the Poor, for the reasons you're flicking at, because they're such sympathetic plaintiffs. And one of the paradoxes of this case is that they themselves are actually exempt from the accommodation, that there's a nationwide injunction that keeps them from having to pay into their insurance to provide contraception to their employees. So it's not even just that they asked to be in the case, and then they become, if you read sort of the press on this, at least from the conservative side, they become the face of this case. You know, these poor nuns who really are doing unbelievable work in the COVID era to help people have dignity at the end of life. But they're the face of this case and they are in no way impacted by it. So it's nuts. And it's just doesn't get any attention.
This is just my suspicion.
Yeah.
But
yep.
This is hilarious.
Yep.
It is so much worse than I thought. So they're exempt anyway.
Yes, yes. And Marty Lederman, like I say, has been banging his head against the wall saying they are not affected by this. They are not subject to this. Why are they the face of this case? And it's deeply weird.
Why do they have standing?
There is, you know, because they were joined to the case, because the courts let them come in as, you know, plaintiff interveners, I guess it's called, and they become, even though they are not the providers in this instance who brought the litigation. So once you have, you know, sweet nuns who, I think Paul Clement, who defended them the last time they were at the court, came on my podcast and said, you know, this would be like asking them to hand out condoms, you know, from the front room as they're doing, you know, the work of their order.
Celia Law v. the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This one really interests me, and I want to ask you about this because I'm wondering about Chevron. And I'm wondering about, this is them trying to get rid of the administrative state.
That's
is that
exactly
right?
Exactly right, yep.
The CFPB has a has one as the head of the CFPB. It's not an agency like the FCC that have a whole bunch of commissioners. This is there's the guy who heads, or the person who heads the CFPB. And he can't be fired by the president except for cause under the statute. You know, the Trump administration wants to be able to fire anybody without cause. Because of the unitary executive, is that right?
Yeah, the idea is they serve at the pleasure of the president, and these efforts in all of these regulatory entities to insulate people from the political headwinds that would mean, you turn over every time there's a new administration. The idea was they serve longer terms than that, and they're not subject to firing just at the whim of the president. And yeah, the claim here is, of course they are. The president can fire whoever he wants, whenever he wants. As you said, this means that, and by a 5-4 margin, the court signed off on that. And again, I think there was an effort to cabinet and say it's just this entity and never mind other agencies that look similar to this. This is a really narrow decision about the CFPB, but I think the dissenters said it's just a short hop from this to saying that any regulatory entity, all of its officers serve at the pleasure of the president.
And I brought up the Chevron doctrine. What is it called? The
deference? Chevron? I think the idea is that it's Chevron deference. Yeah.
Deference. The Chevron deference. Can you explain that real quickly? So what the significance of that is and what it is?
I think it's just the principle that the courts have tended to defer to agencies, to the expertise accumulated in agencies, that they kind of know what they're doing in the regulatory space, and that the court tends to hugely defer to agencies to set their own policies and priorities. And this is a part of dismantling the regulatory state, involves doing away with Chevron deference.
You know, during the Gorsuch confirmation hearings, the Republicans started bringing this up. Ben Sasse from Nebraska started saying things like, on the Affordable Care Act, all those regulations were written by Health and Human Services, and really those should have been written by Congress. And I was thinking, like, are you kidding me? Are you crazy? We passed the Affordable Care Act in beginning in 2010. It really didn't take effect till 2014. Because the regulations had to be written by HHS. We can't get anything done in Congress now. At that time, we could barely get anything done. They can't do anything. They can't do anything. And the idea that Congress would write the regs of something like that, not the agencies, is just insane.
It's insane. And I might just add, we're in the midst of this catastrophic pandemic where one would think that if we've learned nothing else, it's that federal agencies really matter, and it really matters that they function well and with expertise and that they function well in a way that is buffered from politics. I mean, you'd think that at that moment, it might be a good time to say, hey, maybe all regulatory agencies don't suck. And yet, here we are.
Okay. Dreamers. This is Department of Homeland Security versus the Regents of the University of California system. This is interesting because this seemed to be Roberts and the others saying, like, oh, come on, you guys. You know, you can't hand in a paper where you didn't check your spelling and didn't do any of the work and study anything. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, I think for me, the shorthand of this case is the same, Al, as the shorthand for the census case last year, when there was, folks will recall, an effort to put this citizenship question on the census that ostensibly was being done, I think, to shore up the Voting Rights Act or something, but it was in fact being done because, like, Wilbur Ross wanted it, and then they created all these pretexts, and it was just hack work on top of hack work. And John Roberts at the time said, you know, and lawyers were quitting, government lawyers couldn't bear to get up and make the lies anymore. It was so embarrassing. And John Roberts at the end of last term essentially said, lie to me better. Like, if you're going to come and say you need to put this question on the census and it's that the Justice Department wanted it and it's essential for the Voting Rights Act, then just do better lies. And that's exactly what happens. This, and he throws in with the liberals in that case. It's exactly what happens with this rescission of DACA. More or less, the Trump administration initially, first of all, Donald Trump would say, I love the Dreamers. The Dreamers are amazing. Many want to protect them. And then rescinded DACA by way of a tweet. And then the tweet was followed up with just dumb pretextual memos saying, here's why we have to do this and the reasons we're all dumb. And then I think Kirstjen Nielsen came up with a slightly less dumb rationale, but the whole thing was just dumb. And there is this Federal Administrative Procedures Act that says, like, don't do stuff dumbly.
I think it says stupidly.
Stupidly or just hackishly, right? Sloppy, bad spelling, check your footnotes. And so this was another unforced error, one of many, many, many unforced.
Was this a Sessions vestige?
Yes, this was a session, a full-on Sessions screw-up. And they just did it poorly. And when, by the time it got to the U.S. Supreme Court, John Roberts more or less said, if you're going to rescind DACA, find some good reasons for it. Don't do it badly and then tack even dumber stuff to it to try to clean it up. And in some sense, Al, I put this in the bucket where I put June Medical, the abortion case, which is Louisiana, if you want to regulate abortion providers out of existence, I am all in on the project, but just don't lie. Like, don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining. I think that that is, like, could be, if they still had the decals, you know, like the Chief Justice armband that Rehnquist used to have, I think it would just say, like, lie better. I will give you what you want, but just don't lie badly. And that, I think, is the coda to the DACA case.
Well, hopefully we will have a different administration and DACA will continue. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about the commutation of Roger Stone's sentence by President Trump.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We're back with Dahlia Lithwick. As a way of segueing to Stone and the commutation of his sentence, let's talk about the finances, looking at Trump's finances. Explain what happened, and the question I have is, can Vance resolve this quickly and look at this stuff before the election?
So it's two separate cases. One is, as you say, Cy Vance. We've got a grand jury in New York doing an investigation. We don't quite know what they're looking at. We do know that it's something to do with Donald Trump's finances, something to do with these payments that were made to Stormy Daniels and other folks, just a lot of hinkiness that was being investigated by a grand jury. And they subpoenaed, not from Trump, but from Trump's financial, his accountants and banks, a whole bunch of documents to see what had gone on. At the same time, there were a bunch of congressional committees trying to do oversight, saying, you know, either we're trying to reform the ethics laws, or Adam Schiff's committee saying we're trying to make sure that foreign governments are not getting involved in our electoral process. So legitimate grounds that various congressional committees saying they wanted to put laws into place, they couldn't do that without, same thing, Mazars and Deutsche Bank and other lenders trying to figure out what had happened. Donald Trump, as you'll recall, is the first president who doesn't, in decades, who doesn't show us his taxes. So the case really is a question about whether third parties, not the president himself, there's no claim of executive privilege, third parties can conduct some kind of oversight. And the court decides slightly different things in the two. As you said, I think Vance is a kind of resounding defeat for Donald Trump. There are five justices, John Roberts and the liberals, saying, of course, the president is not immune from state grand juries seeking to subpoena their papers. And as you say, there's this weird, I'm kicking it back to the district court, and the district court can hear more of Donald Trump's objections, but certainly his claim that was made at the Second Circuit, his lawyers saying essentially he can do whatever he wants, he can shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, he can never be touched or investigated, his family can't be investigated, pre-presidential acts can't be investigated, all that is wrong. That's Chief Justice Roberts. And as you say, this gets kicked back to the lower courts. The congressional one doesn't fare as well. There we have, it looks like this new fuzzy four-part test that congressional committees are going to have to go back to the lower courts and make a better showing, he says, of why they need to get their hands on these documents. So on the immediate question of whether in the Vance case, the grand jury can get their hands on these records before the 2020 election, I think we're already seeing that there's going to be an attempt to go back to the lower courts and fight it out. I don't think Donald Trump can satisfy even the new Roberts test of this higher showing of why he gets to hide them. But grand juries are bound by secrecy. And the idea that someone is going to leak or we're going to see these documents in time for the November election, I think, is a long shot. And I think it's fairly clear, again, Congress is trying to get busy and meet this high standard, this new higher standard of what they need to show in a district court to get their hands on the documents before the election. I think, again, it's a real, real long shot that anyone is going to see anything before November.
So the grand jury can't indict and then they can release stuff?
Well, you know, that's a question about whether, and there is this longstanding question about whether presidents can be indicted while they're still sitting presidents. And you may recall that's one of the reasons Bob Mueller felt his hands were tied.
I'm mad at Mueller. Okay, let's go to...
Speaking of being mad at Mueller.
Yes, let's go to Roger Stone. This, to me, it's just sickening. It's just sickening. Because basically, this is a president commuting the sentence of a guy who lied to protect the president, right?
Yep. Are we done?
Now, that is crazy.
You know, remember when the sentencing judge sentenced Roger Stone, she said, this is not me sentencing him for, you know, his politics or his association with this president.
She was unbelievably great. Can I read from it?
Yep. Yeah. It's perfect.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. Wow. Here's some of this. He was prosecuted for covering up for the president. This effort to obstruct the investigation was deliberate, planned, not one isolated event, and conducted over a considerable period of time, and Stone lied and sought to impede production of information to whom? Not to some secret anti-Trump cabal, but to Congress, to the elected representatives of both parties who were confronted with a matter of grave national importance. I'll cut to the chase at the end. She says, sure, the defense is free to say, so what? Who cares? But I'll say this, Congress cared. The United States Department of Justice and the United States Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia that prosecuted the case is still prosecuting the case cared. The jurors who served with integrity under difficult circumstances cared. The American people cared, and I care. This is about a guy lying and then tampering with a jury to cover up for the president.
Yeah. No, I think I think that this is the only thing in some sense that needs to be lashed to what the president just did is Judge Berman Jackson's words saying, I'm not punishing him for Trumpism or Trumpist speech, blah, blah. I'm punishing him because he did the thing that Michael Cohen went to jail for. You know, he broke the law to protect this president. And as you just read, all of these people, including the totality of the justice system and the Justice Department, rely on the truth of that being punished. And the idea that the sentence is commuted for doing exactly the thing, which is lying to protect the president. I mean, the amount of self-dealing that we saw with this commutation is unbelievable. He rewarded a person who distorted the justice system and tried to thwart the justice system to benefit himself. It's a perfect circle of grift. It's unbelievable. I agree.
Let me ask you this. So after, let's hope that Biden wins the election. So then he's a private citizen. So now you can indict him. This feels to me like he basically held out, I'll commute your sentence if you don't talk. That's a fair conclusion to draw, isn't it?
I think so. And I think it's kind of the thing that Roger Stone said, right, last week.
Where he That's was right. Like,
dude, I didn't talk. It was put into words.
Now, that to me seems illegal. That seems prosecutable. That seems like you can't do that. You can't hold out. If you don't talk, I'll commute your sentence. And everyone knows what this was. There's no question what this was. You're the lawyer. You're the jurisprudence analyst. Can this be prosecuted? And why wouldn't it be?
I think it certainly looks to me as though, not just prosecuted, but one could imagine in a second, in the event that Trump won again, that it's another impeachable offense. I don't think there's any question that this is destabilizing the entire, legal system, the Justice Department, the court system, the investigatory arm of the Justice Department, all in order to protect somebody who protected him. This is just mob-like. So I don't think there's any question that this is illegal. I'm just reading this really interesting article in The Atlantic, actually claiming that even the commutation is unconstitutional because the pardon power doesn't allow the president to commute the sentence of somebody who was involved in something for which the president himself was impeached. That impeachment clause that the president can't commute the sentence of someone tagged to an impeachment, it's not just that he can't commute the sentence of someone who is impeached, but that this is exactly the conduct that was at the core of president's own impeachment, this kind of grifting, quid pro quoing, and that even the commutation itself is unconstitutional. So I don't know if I understand it fully, but I think it's an interesting problem that the thing that the president has now done is just another iteration of the thing for which he was properly impeached. And it's just, in a world of me saying to you over the years, so bad, this is just so, so bad. It's so bad.
My reaction to that argument in The Atlantic, which I haven't read, but is that he wasn't impeached for Russia and collusion. He was impeached for Ukraine, which they could argue, no. He was corruptly commuted, but it's legal or something. How can this possibly be legal?
I mean, I don't think it is, but I think this goes back to, you remember when Ian Bassin and I were on the show and we talked about how there is such a profound slippage between what is a norm and what is a law and what the Constitution says, and then just all the crap that is none of those things, that is just so unthinkable that we haven't... you know, put it into a framework. And I think this is that. I mean, this is, like I said, this is just straight up how mob bosses protect themselves. And so hopefully if we ever regain sanity, there will be a big reckoning about the failures of both the legal system and the impeachment system and, you know, the whole architecture built by the framers to keep somebody who's just grifted his way, threatened his way, rewarded his allies who lie for him. All of that needs to be rethought. And this is a good place maybe just to remind folks that when Ian and Bass and I were on the show last.
It was a great, by the way, that was a great, very proud of that podcast. You guys are terrific. And I would recommend to anyone listening to this to go back to that, because it was exactly about this, which was the threat to our system.
Yeah, and I think just the one thing that I would flag, because again, I don't think it's gotten nearly enough attention in the mayhem of day-to-day life, but the stuff we were warning about then, you know, what turns into the firing of Jeffrey Berman, you know, in the Eastern District, the firing, the sidelining of Jesse Liu in D.C., you know, the rejiggering of the apparatus of the Justice Department and the power of federal prosecutors so that in line exactly with this Stone commutation, the story being told is that everyone who ever convicts a Trump consigliere is part of this deep state plot. By the way, all that language trotted out again around the commutation. But the fact that the Justice Department is being dismantled and rebuilt to protect Trump cronies and to go after people who spent their lives for 4 years investigating Trump, that is so scary ass terrifying, and it's just not getting the attention it needs.
It just seems to me that a change in administration, and from this unbelievably corrupt, pernicious administration to to a normal one, would do a lot to repair, wouldn't it?
I think so. But I also think, you know, and I think this was Ian Bassin's point when we spoke last, that what we've learned is that soft norms, once they're destroyed, need to be bolstered. And that even if you have people of good character working in good faith at the Justice Department, yes, it will go a long way to reinstilling confidence, but I think that we just have to look at the ways that systems broke down and that systems, you know, at the soft points were distorted to really, really harm folks like Alexander Vindman and all of the
folks. That is so disgraceful.
Yep. Yep.
I hope he can, you know, January 20th, come back and serve as a colonel and get the Presidential Medal of Freedom for his valor. Hey, Lieutenant Colonel, you're back if you want to be. And also you're getting this Presidential Medal of Freedom. I think that'd be a good gesture on January 21st.
I agree.
Now, the Trump people aren't going to disappear. And I don't know what these Republicans in the Senate are going to do. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen 4 months from now. So we don't know. We just don't know. Right now, Trump's been digging himself a hole and continues to dig. As I said, I thought he had all the racists, but he's doubled down on that. And I don't know what the hell he thinks he's doing, but I'm scared about suppression of votes. I'm scared about a lot of things. But other than that, well, thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Al. Thank you for having me. Have a good summer.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.